The fifth chapter of 1 Corinthians is a very important chapter, and we'll be getting to it in a little more detail in a moment. But if you're inclined to listen to the news or read the newspaper, the last couple of weeks have been rather intriguing. For some of you, they may have been a bit disturbing. For others of you, they probably were neither. I was reading an article entitled "Bankruptcies Blamed on Easy Credit." And it said, even though we're in a booming economy, a record number of 1.3 million families filed for bankruptcy. The article went on and quoted lawyers and credit counselors as saying that the availability of easy credit and a tendency to shirk responsibility had played a major role in these bankruptcies. The interesting thing about that article is it was written in 1998, appeared in the San Antonio newspaper. Maybe it was a warning. Maybe it was a beacon. If it was, it went rather unheeded. Well, I don't think the pulpit is the platform for anything political. I doubt any of us can say we really understand some of the confusion of the last week or two. But I would like to make a comment on something that I've noticed, not with great glee, but neither did I notice it with great surprise the last couple of weeks. Have you ever noticed, and I know you have, how the fact that we're going to have to spend $700 billion, and that's just the tip, probably a tip of an iceberg, it's nobody's fault. Nobody's to blame. And as I would read the newspaper or hear the news, I often wondered if half as much energy would go into solving problems as opposed to making sure that we're not blamed for them, maybe we'd have fewer problems. Today, you or I get into financial trouble. It's not our fault. It's because of easy credit. And the government needs to do something to protect us. If I develop lung cancer from smoking, it's not my fault. It's the cigarette company's fault. If I go into a rage and grab a gun and start shooting people, I'm not responsible. It's my genes and my environment. Sexual perversion is not my fault. It's the way God made me. As a society, we've become adept, maybe I should say, professionals at blaming others. Well, that's sad. But it can even be sadder if those things dare infiltrate the church. We begin to fall away from the Lord. And we start thinking, it's not my fault. It's the church's fault. They weren't friendly enough. They didn't meet my needs. Or the speakers weren't very interesting. Whatever, it's not our fault. People are blaming hereditary, environment, chemical imbalance, job pressures, poverty, prejudices, abuses, and anything else they can think of for problems today. This is not my favorite lesson to present. And I don't present it to this group in a rebuking tone. I simply present it to you as a reminding tone. There are places that I go, I would probably present this lesson somewhat in a rebuking tone. But I want to deal with discipline. A UCLA sociologist by the name of James Wilson observed an interesting thing about city life. And being at UCLA, he was surrounded by LA and a lot of city life. He observed and wrote about how the crime rate, escalates on those streets where broken windows are not repaired. He did a study and found that the crime rate increased on streets where broken windows were not repaired. Failure to replace broken windows makes an announcement, he said, to the public that the standards have been lowered and authority abandoned. Wilson saw such practices of disrepair as an invitation for further crime without the threat of adverse consequences. And his article happened to be carried also, if you ever want to read it, in the 1995 Reader's Digest. But it occurred to me as I reflected on that, that what is true in the streets of an inner city could also be true of a Christian's life. Could also be true of the church. When sin and unscriptural practices are allowed to go unchecked, we invite destruction into the Lord's church, period. When we exercise the discipline needed to stop and to repair damaging behavior in the church or in our lives, we erect a fence of protection that I believe can often discourage further erosion. I believe all congregations have the same problem. And the problem isn't how many baptisms they have per year. The problem isn't how much they give on the Lord's Day or how much they evangelize, although those are important. The problem that every congregation I know of struggles with is the problem of sin. Because that's the problem every Christian struggles with. That rebelliousness that tells God, I've got another way of doing it. It seems to me in the last few decades, there are three attitudes that have become prevalent in our world. And they have become the gods of our society. Unfortunately, it's not Jehovah that is the God of our society. And I want to comment on these three for just a moment. The first one is open-mindedness. The second one is total acceptance. And the third one is privacy. I believe those have become the three gods of our society. First of all, open-mindedness. I believe it's considered the highest of all character qualities in our society. And it's good in the sense of what it used to mean. Willingness to consider viable options. But that's not what open-mindedness means today, in my opinion. Today, I believe when the term is used, it often means that there is no such thing as absolute truth. What's true for me may not be true for another. Truth is relative to circumstances, and truth is constantly, therefore, changing. Sadly, this mindset can creep into the church. So much that for all practical purposes, the concept of church discipline completely disappears. Number two, total acceptance. We are today encouraged, I almost could say we are today demanded, to accept the behavior of those around us, the cry to be tolerant. And the price for intolerance today is to be called ignorant or even a bigot. Don't judge me, you have no right. We'll get back to that in a little later in my lesson. Can you see the flaws of that thinking? But it can and has sometimes crept even into the church. Many church members today, I am convinced, view membership in the Lord's church as a right. It is not a right. Membership in the Lord's church is a privilege. And that is not simply a semantical difference. It is a key difference. And with the privilege of being a member of the Lord's church comes responsibilities and accountability. And unless you and I pick up those responsibilities and accountabilities, I question whether or not we are truly members of the Lord's church, although He will be the judge. Just as parents are expected to exercise discipline over their children, God commands, He doesn't suggest, I believe He commands, that the local congregation exercise discipline and accountability over and with its members. Probably the reason that some people reject membership in a local congregation. They don't want to be held responsible or accountable by anybody. And one reason church discipline has often gone by the wayside is that we're afraid of being labeled judgmental. Number three, privacy. Stay out of my life. It's none of your business, and it's private. That is totally foreign to the teachings of the New Testament. If that were true, there would be little need for the church. In America, privacy has been elevated to constitutional status. When you see congressmen interviewing or discussing with potential appointees to the court system, they always bring up, what's your position on privacy? And if you haven't noticed that, notice it next time. Many current issues hide behind privacy. Abortion, sexual orientation. It's nobody's business. It's private. The issue of privacy can also invade the home. Kids telling their parents, you have no right to invade my privacy. Stay out of my room. I hope no parent here has ever heard that, but I suspect they have. I hope no child here has ever said it, but I suspect they have. I was reading an article on this one time, and I liked the person's take on it. Maybe it was a little harsh. But he was discussing a family that was having trouble with, pardon me, a teenager. And the teenager would always run in and lock their bedroom door. And the father says, what do I do? What can I do? And the counselor told him, the next time, or if my teenager ever did that, the next time the teen came home from school, there would be no door. Now that might be a bit harsh, but I think it drives home this issue of privacy. Now some of you parents are enjoying this story way too much, so just get those smirks off your face, okay? I hope you see the point. Parents, in my opinion, not only have the right, they have the responsibility for knowing what's going on in their children's lives, door or no door. Now, I understand, as they grow, we need to trust them. And as they earn that trust, privacy should come, sure. But it's a privilege, not a right. And the same is true in the church. The elders of this congregation have every right to ask any of us that are members of this congregation what is going on in our lives and to ask, as far as I'm concerned, almost any question they want to. Now, I think they're discerning men. They're going to use that without abusing it. But that's part of being a family. And I haven't gotten this from Randy or Gerald, but I've gotten it from other elders, and I've seen it when I was an elder. This attitude, it's none of your business. It is. Because the church is a one another organization, and we're to be concerned one for another. Unfortunately, too many times the church has become a thermometer reflecting the temperature of its environment rather than a thermostat setting the temperature of its environment. And that's what happens when discipline is neglected. In 1 Corinthians 5, that Dylan read for us, and I appreciate him coming and asking if there was anything he could read. I'm not going to reread that chapter. It's not an unfamiliar chapter to most of you. It's not a fun chapter. But it's there for a purpose. And it seems to me as I go down through the fifth chapter of Corinthians, there are really three sections, if you will. There's first the reporting of the sin. Secondly, then there is the removal of the sin. And if we tie this to 2 Corinthians chapter 2, it appears that there was a repenting of the sin. Notice in verse 1, it is reported commonly that there is sin. This was not a secret. It wasn't even something that only the church knew about. Verse 1 says it was something the Gentiles, something the community knew about. It was open. It was flagrant. It wasn't just a rumor. It says that things like that weren't even named among the Gentiles. Even the Gentiles, or even those that weren't part of the church, knew that this was wrong. You remember when David sinned with Bathsheba? It appears to me David didn't break one of the Ten Commandments. I think David broke seven of the Ten Commandments when he sinned with Bathsheba. He coveted. He made lust his god. He committed adultery. He lied. He stole. He killed. And he covered it up. The goal of church discipline is never to get even. And the goal of church discipline is never to get rid of someone, but to get rid of something, sin, and to restore the one that has fallen. And when we, as individuals or as a congregation, refuse to confront that, we give the erring one a false sense of security that it's all right, but we also give all of the eyes watching us an indication that it must be all right also. I don't remember what state this occurred in, but it's been a few years ago. We've all probably been to the fast food stores, be it a McDonald's. This happened to be a Burger King. And they have the little playpen for the kid, or playground for the kids. It's for older kids too. But they have these little balls, and it's a whole pit of them, and you can go jump in them. And we adults wish we could, but we think probably that's not right. So some of us don't. I don't know about you. I believe it was in southwestern America a few years ago, and the bottom of one of those pits with all those little balls in, they found a rattlesnake. Now, who here would want their children or grandchildren to go jump into the pit of little plastic balls with a rattlesnake in the bottom of it? Well, the answer is nobody. But would you want to play in a congregation where there's sin? Would you want to fellowship and worship in a congregation that didn't exercise church discipline? Sin is serious. It's like a rattler in a crib with a baby. It's like a maniac loose with a knife in a nursing home. Sin is what nailed Jesus to the cross. And therefore, it deserves to be taken very, very seriously, even when it's easier not to. 1 Corinthians 5 is not the only. It's a lot like this morning. I used the passage in 1 Timothy 4, but I said there are many other passages. 1 Corinthians 5 is not the only passage that deals with this. Galatians chapter 6, verse 1. You which are spiritual, take heed unto yourself, but restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 and 16. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14. Romans chapter 16, verse 17. It says, mark those that cause divisions. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 3, 4, and 5. Titus chapter 3, verse 10. 1 Timothy 1 and 20. Where there it says, for two gentlemen to be delivered unto Satan, that they may be restored. But I chose, because of its familiarity, 1 Corinthians 5. And again, I'm not going to reread this. It's already been read very well. But just follow with me mentally or with your Bibles as I just pull out a few snippets. Verse 2. And ye are puffed up and have not rather mourned that he that hath done this deed might be taken away from among you. Paul instructs them, take this sin away from you. And if it requires action against the one committing the sin, so be it. In verse 5, the only other place other than 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 20, where Paul uses the term deliver someone unto Satan, which has got to be a most serious act, he says to this man who is committing fornication, apparently with his mother-in-law, deliver him unto Satan. Verse 7, the leaven verse. Purge it out because it's going to spread. Verse 13. Therefore put away from among you that wicked person. Verse 11. Keep no company with them. It's fellowship broken is what it is. Fellowship should be the most precious thing for any of us. Fellowship with the Lord and fellowship with one another. And the breaking of that should therefore be, for a truly godly heart, the sternest and most effective way to get that person back to the Lord. In Matthew chapter 18, verses 15, 16, and 17, and I hope these are also familiar with you, Jesus gives us that beautiful three-step procedure. If a brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between you and him. Just the two of you. And if he will hear thee, you've gained a brother. But if he won't hear you, then take one or two. Now we've gone from one-on-one to taking just two or three of us and going and talking to them. And if he'll neglect that, verse 17, then we bring it to the entire church. One-on-one, then with witnesses, and then the whole church. But whatever, it's not a glossing over or thinking it's just going to go away if it's not addressed. That's as foolish, you know. That is more foolish than thinking cancer is going to go away if you just ignore it. I mentioned earlier under privacy the concept of don't judge me, judge not. And many will say, well, doesn't Jesus say, judge not? Yes, he does. Matthew chapter 7, verse 1. Judge not that you be not judged. But that verse, like every other verse, we've got to remember to take it in context. When we at this congregation selected elders and deacons, and maybe many of you, I hope all of you that were members at the time, submitted your suggestions or recommendations. Did you make judgments about people when you did that? Of course you did. If you're married, did you make any judgments about the person you married before you married them? I sure hope so. The issue isn't that. To alleviate judgment would be absolute foolishness, wasn't it? But that's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is not condemning judgment. He's condemning, in this passage, hypocritical judgment. And he says, well, you're going to be judged with however you judge. He's saying, don't judge as if you have no sin. Don't judge with a double standard. But he's not saying, don't make judgments. In 1 Corinthians 5, the church was not judging and disciplining a man engaged in sexual immorality. And Paul says in verses 12 and 13 of 1 Corinthians 5, "For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church you are to judge? God judges those outside, purge the evil from among you." Paul instructs the church at Corinth, you've got a job to do making assessments of one another and correcting one another when necessary. And if that doesn't work, it could come to the point of having to sever your fellowship one with another. But even then, you and I are not really judging. We are simply, if we're doing it biblically, applying God's judgments to it. I don't have the right to judge anybody, but God has given us the responsibility to apply His judgments to each of us. Fornication is not wrong because I think it's wrong. It's wrong because God says it wrong is wrong. Murder is not wrong because I think it's wrong. It's wrong because God says it's wrong. And the same is true of every possible sin. Church discipline does not contradict God's commandment of love. It is, I believe, oftentimes the ultimate expression of God's commandment to love. The idea that I will take care of me and you take care of you and never the twain shall meet is a very American philosophy, but it is not Christian. We are to be one another accountability partners. And doesn't Hebrews chapter 12, verse 6 and 7 say, God, who God loves, He chastens. Every one of us, every Christian shares the responsibility of making sure that church discipline is carried out in a positive and scriptural manner. And it is designed to eliminate the problem, not the person. James chapter 5, verses 19 and 20 says, if you bring somebody back, you have brought them back from the fires. And it's said in a very, very positive sense. I think church discipline is obviously important for the purity of the church, but I think it also is important because I believe church discipline done right is one of the key evangelistic tools available. Now, when I say it's one of the key evangelistic tools, I'm not naive enough to say it's one of the quickest ways to fill the building. But filling the building does not mean we've been successful in our evangelizing. Food will fill the building, but that's not evangelizing. Each one of us gives a testimony with our lives. We talked about that some this morning. But I believe each congregation gives a testimony with the way it conducts itself. When non-believers come into contact with the church, many of them are inspecting it carefully. And God bless them for doing it. They have every right to do that, in my opinion. If I were an unbeliever, I would want to inspect it before I participated in it. And sometimes non-believers may have a more accurate evaluation of the congregation than you and I do. We can get trapped into getting used to everything, be it good or bad. But obeying areas of church purity and discipline communicates that we take the Lord's teachings and we take the Lord's authority seriously. There are churches, and I won't mention them, and this may or may not surprise you, that have not had any church discipline for 20 plus years. Now maybe that's fine. It's just hard for me to think that there's been no need for it in that period of time. I believe purity and discipline are even attractive to the lost. That's why I think it can be one of our evangelistic tools. Now, I'm not going to say knock on the door and start the conversation by saying, you want to see some discipline, come to our church. But I do think people appreciate that. I think children appreciate it in the long run, not necessarily in the short term. But when the lost see apathy, negligence, callousness among us, it doesn't matter how good the preaching is, all they're going to see is hypocrisy. And maybe rightfully so. And many of them will probably or maybe do sometimes conclude there's nothing special about the gospel and there's nothing special about the Lord's church as those people practice it. Sin is like an octopus, multiple tentacles. Unconfronted sin and neglect can and does reach out and affect a lot of people. I believe God takes care of the church that is willing to practice biblical discipline. Because I believe, according to scriptures, that a pure church is a powerful church. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 6 through 10 seem to indicate this young man who was disciplined in 1 Corinthians 5 may well have come back. It's not for sure, but it certainly intimates that. And that's always the goal of discipline. But brothers and sisters, sometimes it's the lack of confronting a problem that causes conflicts to arise. You ever have mold in your house? Everybody here has had mold in their house. What did you do about it? Did you just leave it there? Or gangrene in the body. What do? Well, it'll just take care of itself. No, that would be foolish, wouldn't it? But sometimes churches are tempted to remain superficial because they're afraid of conflict. Whenever an issue comes up that might cause tension or discomfort, it gets glossed over in order to preserve a false sense of peace. And we can become, if we're not careful, Mr. and Mrs. Do Not Rock the Boats. We jump in and try to smooth everyone's ruffled feathers. The issue is never resolved and everyone lives with an underlying frustration. Everybody knows the problem is there, but nobody talks about it openly. And that creates an environment of gossip and deterioration. You know, Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount and in what we often call the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers. But let's all remember, peacemaking in a congregation or in individuals' lives, peacemaking does not happen by avoiding sin and the conflict that can come from removing it. Peacemaking comes when sin is addressed in the way that honors God. Because nothing can trump holiness. No matter who they're related to, no matter how long you or I may have been into the church, no matter how generous you or I might be as we give upon the Lord's Day, sin must be dealt with. And confronting sin and confronting someone sinning is not always easy. In fact, I don't think God ever intended it to be easy. It's not easy, but it is godly. It is godly. Our Father cares. Therefore, He gave us His Word to correct us. And He gave us one another to help us see His Word. I want to repeat, I think you heard me the first time, I'm not presenting this lesson here in any way in a rebuking tone, because I think the congregation, the leaders of this congregation have done or do a diligent job in this area. I do present it as a reminder for us as a congregation, but I also present it as a reminder for us as individuals that we all have the responsibility of doing this, not just our officers. The Lord teaches us that as human beings, we are created higher than just plants and higher than the other animals. And we make choices.
We can choose to be good. We can choose to be bad. We can choose to obey God. We can choose to disobey Him. We can choose to be God's man or God's woman. But always remember, we are responsible for choosing. We are responsible for choosing. We're going to close our thoughts tonight and extend the gospel invitation. Let the church be pure. The congregation that we have here is not perfect. But in my humble opinion, it does a pretty good job at remaining pure. That doesn't happen by accident. It happens because a lot of men and women who have lived and already died set that standard to help us understand scriptures. It happens because you and I, as members of this congregation, don't forget our responsibility in this regard. Because if we do, it will cease to be pure. I remember talking to a person a few years ago. And the person, I was asking them, they weren't members of the church. I asked them what church they were a member of, and they gave me the name of the church. That's irrelevant. But then they said, but I haven't been there for 5 years. And I thought to myself, there's no discipline. I don't blame this person because this person simply didn't know better at that moment. Membership is not a right. Membership is a responsibility and a privilege. And as a privilege, with it comes accountability. Paul tells us in Romans chapter 14, verse 12, that every one of us will have to give an account. If we can help anybody this evening, maybe you're not a member of the church and would love to be. Well, that's wonderful. That's one of the things that Scripture says makes the angels rejoice. It makes us rejoice. It's not drudgery to be a member of the Lord's church. There are responsibilities, but what a wonderful, wonderful support system it is. To have men and women who would give you the proverbial shirts off of their back. Know people like that? Well, you know a lot of people like that. And it's a relationship that the world doesn't understand. But they can't understand. It's only something you can understand when you have the joy of participating in it. If you'd like to be part of God's family, the invitation is open. If we can help you, if you've not been baptized, if you've been baptized and need to come back, whatever. What a privilege. If we can help in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.